October 18th, 2006, Dhammasuka Meditation Center, Venerable Uzi Mala Ramsey. Tonight the talk is the Great Division, the Mahavagga, from the Book of Discipline.
A while back I was telling you that the Book of Discipline has a lot of good stories and such in it. And the start of the Mahavagga is one such place. At one time the Awakened One, the Lord, being recently fully enlightened, was staying at Ruvela on the bank of the river Niranjara, at the foot of the Tree of Awakening, the Bodhi Tree. Then the Lord sat cross-legged in one posture for 7 days at the foot of the Tree of Awakening, experiencing the bliss of freedom. Then the Lord, during the first watch of the night, paid attention to causal arising, dependent origination, the arising part of it, in direct and then in reverse order. Conditioned by ignorance are habitual tendencies, formations. Conditioned by formations is consciousness. Conditioned by consciousness is mentality, materiality. Conditioned by mentality, materiality are the six sense bases. Conditioned by the six sense bases is clinging. Conditioned by clinging, six sense bases. It says awareness, so it's supposed to be contact. Contact. Conditioned by contact is feeling. Conditioned by feeling is craving. Conditioned by craving is clinging. Conditioned by clinging is habitual tendency. Conditioned by habitual tendency is birth. Conditioned by earth, birth, old age, and dying. Grief, sorrow, lamentation, and despair come into being. Such is the arising of this whole mass of suffering. But from the utter fading away and stopping of this very ignorance comes the stopping of formations. From the stopping of formations comes the stopping of consciousness. From the stopping of consciousness comes the stopping of mentality, materiality. From the stopping of mentality, materiality, the stopping of the six sense bases. From the stopping of the six sense bases, the stopping of contact. From the stopping of contact, the stopping of feeling. From the stopping of feeling, the stopping of craving. From the stopping of craving, the stopping of clinging. From the stopping of clinging, the stopping of habitual tendency. From the stopping of habitual tendency, the stopping of birth. From the stopping of birth, old age, sickness, death, grief, sorrow, lamentation, pain, and despair cease. Such is the stopping of this whole mass of ill. Then the Buddha, having understood this matter at that time, uttered this solemn utterance: truly, when things grow plain to the ardent meditating Brahman, his doubts all vanish in that he comprehends thing with cause. When the Buddha, during the middle watch of the night, paid attention to causal arising in direct and reverse order, conditioned by ignorance, and we go through the whole thing, then the Buddha, having understood this matter at the time, uttered this solemn utterance: truly, when things grow plain to the ardent meditating Brahman, his doubts all vanish in that he discerns destruction of the cause. Then the Buddha, during the last watch of the night, paid attention to the causal uprising in direct and reverse order. Then the Lord, having understood this matter at one time, uttered this solemn verse: truly, when things grow plain to the ardent meditating Brahman, routing the host of Mara does he stand, as the sun when lighting up the sky. Then the Buddha, having emerged from that contemplation at the end of 7 days, he spent 7 days, that was the first thing he contemplated, right after he gained full awakenment. He approached the goatherd's banyan at the foot of the tree of awakening. Having approached, he sat down cross-legged in one posture for 7 days at the foot of the goatherd's banyan, experiencing the bliss of freedom. Then a certain Brahmin of the class uttering the sound, hmm, approached the Lord. Having approached, he exchanged greetings with the Buddha. Having exchanged greetings in friendliness and courtesy, he stood at a respectful distance. As he was standing at a respectful distance, that Brahmin spoke thus to the Buddha, "To what extent, good Gotama, does one become a Brahmin?" And again, what are the things which make a Brahmin? Then the Buddha, having understood this matter at the time, uttered this solemn utterance. This is translated by I.B. Horner in 1951. So she's really into her old English stuff. So that's why it's written like this. That Brahmin who bars out all evil things, not uttering the sound hum, with no impurity, curbed of self, master of Vedas, who lives with a Brahmin faring, this is the Brahmin who may rightly speak the Brahmin speech, who has no blemishes anywhere in the world. Then the Buddha, at the end of 7 days, having emerged from that contemplation, approached the Mukalinda tree from the foot of the goatherd's banyan. Having approached, he sat down cross-legged in one posture for 7 days at the foot of the Mukalinda, experiencing the bliss of freedom. Now at that time, a great storm arose out of due season. For 7 days there was rainy weather, cold winds, and overcast skies. Then Mukalinda, the serpent king, having come forth from his own haunt, having encircled the Lord's body 7 times with his coils, having spread his great hood over his head, stood saying, "Let no cold annoy the Lord. Let no heat annoy the Lord. Let not the touch of flies, mosquitoes, wind and heat, or creeping things annoy the Buddha." Then Mukalinda, the serpent king, at the end of those 7 days, having known that the sky was clear and without a cloud, having unwound his coils from the Buddha's body, having given up his own form and assumed a youth's form, stood in front of the Buddha, honoring the Buddha with joined palms. Then the Lord, having understood this matter at that time, uttered this solemn utterance, "Happy his solitude who glad at heart hath Dhamma learned and doth the vision see. Happy is the benignity towards the world, which on no creature worketh harm. Happy the absence of all lust, past and beyond the needs of sensual desires. He who hath crushed the great I am conceit, thus truly is happiness supreme." Then the Buddha, at the end of 7 days, having emerged from that contemplation, approached Rajayatana from the foot of the Mukalinda. Having approached, he sat cross-legged in one posture for 7 days at the foot of the Rajayatana, experiencing the bliss of freedom. Now at that time, the merchants Tupusa and Balika were going the high road to that district. Then a Devata, who was blood relation of the merchants, spoke thus to the merchants and said, "My good fellows, this Lord, having just become fully awakened, is staying at the foot of the Rajayatana. go and serve the Lord with barley gruel and honey balls, and this will be a blessing and happiness for you for a long time. Now, according to the Burmese, these two merchants were Burmese, and they were traveling in India going back to Burma. Okay, then these two merchants, having taken barley gruel and honey balls, approached the Lord. Having greeted the Lord, he stood at a respectful distance. As they were standing at a respectful distance, the merchant spoke thus to the Lord, "Lord, let the Lord receive our barley gruel and honey balls, that this may be a blessing and happiness for a long time." Now, actually, what was happening was the Buddha became enlightened, and for 7 weeks he sat under different trees, and he spent 1 week standing just looking at the Bodhi tree. He didn't eat, so he was starting to get a little bit on the grumpy side, I suppose, because he was hungry. Not really grumpy, I can't say that, but then it occurred to the Lord, truth finders do not receive with their hands. Now, with what shall I receive the barley gruel and honey balls? Then the four great kings, those are the elemental devas, knowing with their minds the reasoning of the Lord's mind, from the four corners presented the Lord with four bowls made of rock crystal, saying, "Lord, let the Lord receive the barley gruel and honey balls therein." The Buddha received the honey balls and the barley gruel in a new bowl made of rock crystal, and having received them, he partook of them. Then the merchants, having found that the Buddha had removed his hand from the bowl, having inclined their head towards the Buddha's feet, spoke thus to the Buddha, "We are those going to the Buddha for refuge and to Dhamma. Let the Buddha accept us as lay disciples gone for refuge for life from this day forth." Thus, these two merchants came to be the first lay disciples in the world, using the two-word formula. There was no Sangha, so it was just the Buddha and the Dhamma. That's why it was a two-word formula. Then the Buddha, having emerged from that contemplation at the end of 7 days, approached the goatherd Banyans from the foot of the Rajayatana. One of the things that he did was the Buddha took out some hairs and gave them to these merchants. Now, over the years, those hairs have multiplied many, many, many times. And there's hairs all over the Burma in pagodas of the Buddha. And they say that the actual hair came and was put in the Shwedagon pagoda. But the Shwedagon pagoda wasn't built for 200 years after the Buddha's death. Now, they might have found some way of preserving it. I'm sure they probably did, and they might actually have put it in that pagoda. But the first pagoda was built by Asoka, and it was only 20 feet high. You go to the Shwedagon pagoda now, and it's 370-some feet. And it's all gold, and they went through a lot of different periods of making a pagoda over the old pagoda and making it bigger with different patterns and different designs. And it wasn't until about 1000 AD that a princess came up with the design of the Shwedagon pagoda now, and everybody agreed that that was really the best looking pagoda around. So they kept that shape. One thing that I noticed when I was in Asia is in Thailand, they don't have their proportions right. So their temples, they look real long and narrow. And it's just not, it looks like a pencil when you look at it straight on. And it just, it's out of proportion. The Burmese actually are pretty good with proportion. And that's why the Shwe Dagon, it's pleasing when you see it. But it's also, they light it up at night. They have spotlights on it so you can see it from all over the city. It's incredibly beautiful, and it's really magical to go there in the evening. And they have, oh, there's lots of other small pagodas around and all of this, but the main one is the Shwe Dagon Pagoda. Around 12, I don't remember the date, there was a monk that made a Buddha image. And inside that, he put a lot of rubies. And then he got this blood red ruby. You have to pay to get in to see that. It's, they have all these little tiny pagodas all the way around the outside, and there's only one stair up that you can go to the Shwe Dagon and actually get close to it. And it so happened that I wanted to see that. I heard about this Buddha from Musilananda, and he kept on telling me how incredibly powerful this Buddha is and so wonderful. And I was talking to another monk, and a man overheard me, and he paid my way in. And it's really not a huge Buddha. It's only, oh, maybe 3 feet tall. But it is real special. Really special. Very, very nice feel to it. And then we walked around the inside walkway around the Shwe Dagon, touching the pagoda as we went along. It was kind of neat. But when they light it up at night, you can see that thing from anywhere in Rangoon, and it is just gorgeous. A lot of people will be walking, and then they'll look at it, and they'll just stop and do their metta and that sort of thing, because it's the most beloved pagoda in all of Burma. Where the Shwe Dagon Pagoda is on a hill. Rangoon is reasonably flat most places. There's a few little bumps in the road, you know, just little tiny. But this particular hill, it probably goes up 200 or 300 feet. And it's a covered walkway going up, and there's all kinds of stalls going in there, and you can get all kinds of carvings and bells and fans and anything that you can think of, you can get going up to there. When I was there, they just had installed an escalator. Now, they'd never seen an escalator in Burma before, but everybody wanted to walk up and then ride down. And we're getting about ready to go down, and there's this cluster of people, and there's nobody on the escalator. And they saw us coming, and because we were monks, they got out of the way, and they got on the escalator and went down, you know. The Burmese monk right behind me grabbed onto my hand, because he was afraid. But when they saw how easy it was to get on, because they were real unsure about these moving steps, they thought that was really tricky, but they saw how easy it is to get on, then they started coming down after that. Anyway, then as the Buddha was meditating in seclusion, a reasoning arose in his mind thus: the Dhamma won by me is deep, difficult to see, difficult to understand, peaceful and excellent beyond dialectic, subtle, intelligible to the learned. But this is a creation delighted in sensual pleasure, delighted by sensual pleasure, rejoicing in sensual pleasure, so that a creation delighting in sensual pleasure, delighted by sensual pleasure, rejoicing in sensual pleasure, this were a matter difficult to see, that is to say, causal arising by way of cause. Now you see how many times in how many different books we're talking about this is what the experience of Nibbana is, and it's not being taught right now, except by me and a few others. This too were a matter very difficult to see, that to say, the calming of all habitual tendencies, a renunciation of all attachment, the destruction of craving, dispassion, stopping nirvana. And so, if I were to teach Dhamma and others were not to understand me, this world would be a weariness to me. This would be a vexation to me. And further, these verses, not heard before in the past, occurred spontaneously to the Buddha. This, that through many toils I've won enough, why should I make it known? By folks with lust and hate consumed, this Dhamma is not understood. Leading on against the stream, subtle, deep, difficult to see, delicate, unseen, 'twill be by passion slaves, cloaked in the murk of ignorance. In such wise the Buddha pondered, his mind inclined to little effort and not teaching Dhamma. Then it occurred to the Brahmin Samhapati, knowing his mind, the reasoning of the Buddha's mind, alas, the world is lost. Alas, the world is destroyed, inasmuch as the mind of the truth finder, the perfect one, the perfected one, the fully awakened one, inclines to little effort and not teaching the Dhamma. Then, as a strong man might stretch forth his bent arm, or might bend back his outstretched arm, even so did Brahma Samhapati, vanishing from the Brahma world, became manifest before the Buddha. Then the Brahman Samhapati, having arranged his upper robe over one shoulder, having stooped his right knee to the ground, having saluted the Buddha with joined palms, spoke thus to the Buddha, Lord, let the Lord teach Dhamma. Let the welfarer teach Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who, not hearing the Dhamma, are decaying. But if they are learners of Dhamma, they will grow. Thus spoke the Brahma Samhapati. Having said this, he further spoke, There has appeared in the Magadha before thee an unclean Dhamma by impure minds devised. Open this door to the deathless. Let them hear Dhamma awakened to by the stainless one. As on a crag of crest of mountain, standing a man might watch people far below, even so do thou, O wisdom fair, ascending, a seer of all, the terraced heights of truth. Look down from grief released upon the people sunken in grief, oppressed with birth and age. Arise, O hero, conqueror in the battle, thou freed from debt, man of the caravan, walk the world over. Let the Blessed One teach Dhamma. They who learn will grow. When he'd spoken thus, the Buddha spoke thus to the Brahma Samhapati. Brahma, it occurred to me this Dhamma penetrated by me is deep, and it would be difficult to teach. That would be a vexation to me. And further, Brahma, these verses, not heard before in the past, occurred spontaneously to me. This, that through the many toils I have won, why should I teach them? They're cloaked in the murk of ignorance. In such wise, Brahma, as I pondered, my mind inclined to little effort in not teaching the Dhamma. Then a second time did the Brahma Samhapati speak thus to the Lord, let the Lord teach the Dhamma. For the second time did the Lord speak thus to Brahma Samhapati. But Brahma, it occurred to me, my mind inclined to little effort in not teaching Dhamma. Then a third time the Brahma Samhapati spoke thus, Lord, let the Lord teach Dhamma. If they are learners of Dhamma, they will grow. Then the Lord, having understood Brahma's entry, out of compassion for being, surveyed the world with the eye of an awakened one. As the Lord was surveying the world with the eye of an awakened one, he saw beings with little dust in their eyes, with much dust in their eyes, with acute faculties, with dull faculties, with good disposition, with bad disposition, docile, indocile, few seeing fear in sins and the worlds beyond. Even as in a pond of blue lotuses, or a pond of red lotuses, or a pond of white lotuses, a few blue, a few red, a few white lotuses are born in the water, grow in the water, do not rise above the water, but thrive while altogether emerged. A few blue or red or white lotuses are born in the water, grow in the water, and reach the surface of the water. A few blue or red or white lotuses are born in the water, grow in the water, and stand up, raising out of the water, undefiled by the water. Even so did the Buddha, surveying the world with the eye of an awakened one, seeing beings with little dust in their eyes, with much dust in their eyes, with faculties acute, with dull faculties, with good dispositions and bad dispositions, docile, indocile, few seeing fear in the sins and the worlds beyond, seeing Brahma Samhapati, addressed him with verse, open for those who hear are the doors of the deathless. Let them renounce their faith. Thinking of a useless fatigue, I have not preached Brahma, the sublime and the excellent Dhamma to men. Then Brahma Samhapati, thinking the opportunity was made by me for the Buddha to teach Dhamma, greeting the Buddha, keeping him on his right side, towards him, vanished as then and there. Then it occurred to the Buddha, now to whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? Then it occurred to the Buddha, indeed, this Alura, the Kalama, is learned, experienced, wise, and for a long time has had little dust in his eyes. Suppose I were to teach Dhamma first to Alura the Kalama. He will understand this Dhamma quickly. But then an invisible Devata announced to the Lord, Lord, Alura the Kalama passed away 7 days ago. And the knowledge arose in the Buddha that Alura the Kalama had passed away 7 days ago. Then it occurred to the Buddha, Alura the Kalama has great intelligence. If he had heard this Dhamma, he would have understood it quickly. Then it occurred to the Buddha, now, To whom should I first teach Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? Then it occurred to the Buddha, indeed, Uddaka, Rama's son, is learned, experienced, wise, and for a long time has had little dust in his eyes. Suppose I were to teach Dhamma first to Uddaka, Rama's son. He will understand this Dhamma quickly. But then an invisible devata announced to the Buddha, Lord Uddaka, Rama's son, passed away last night. Tough luck. And the knowledge arose in the Buddha that Uddaka, Rama's son, had passed away last night. Then it occurred to the Buddha, Uddaka, Rama's son, was of great intelligence. If he had heard this Dhamma, he would have understood it quickly. Then it occurred to the Buddha, now to whom should I teach Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? Then it occurred to the Buddha, that group of five monks who waited on me when I was self-resolved in striving were very helpful. Suppose I were to teach Dhamma first to this group of five monks. Then it occurred to the Lord, but where is this group of five monks staying at present? Then the Buddha, with a deva vision, purified and surpassing that of men, saw the group of five monks staying at Benares in Isipatana in the deer park. When the Lord, having stayed at Uvala as long as he found suiting, set out on tour for Benares, Upaka, the naked ascetic, saw the Lord coming along the high road between Gaya and the Tree of Awakening. Seeing him, he spoke thus to the Buddha, Your reverence, your sense organs are quite pure, your complexion very bright, very clear. On account of whom have you, your reverence, gone forth? Or who is your teacher? Or whose Dhamma do you profess? When this was said, the Buddha addressed Upaka, the naked ascetic, in verse, Victorious over all, omniscient am I, among all things undefiled, leaving all through the death of craving freed. By knowing for myself, whom should I follow? For me there is no teacher, one like me does not exist in the world with the devas. No one equals me. For I am perfected in the world. The teacher supreme am I. I alone am all awakened. Become cool am I. Nibbana attained. To turn the wheel of Dhamma, I go to Kasi city. Beating the drum of the deathless in a world that's blind become. According to what you claim, your reverence, you ought to be victor of the unending, Upaka said. Like me, there are victors indeed who have won the destruction of the cankers. Vanquished by me are evil things. Therefore am I, Upaka, a victor. When this was said, Upaka, the naked ascetic, having said, It may be so, your reverence, having shaken his head, went off in a different road. Now, there's a lot of speculation about this, that the Buddha went on this road to show him how clear his senses were and all of that, and it impressed him, and later he became a monk. And became one of the arahats. But it's a little hard to run across somebody that says, I don't have a teacher, I learned everything on my own, and I'm the best in the world. Hard to believe at first. Then the Lord, walking on tour in due course, approached Benares, the deer park of Isipatana. The group of five monks saw the Lord coming in the distance. Seeing him, they agreed among themselves, saying, Your reverences, This recluse Gotama is coming. He lives in abundance. He is wavering in his striving. He has reverted to the life of abundance. He should neither be greeted, nor stood up for, nor should his bowl and robe be received. For all the same, a seat may be put out. He can sit down if he wants to. But as the Lord gradually approached this group of five monks, so this group of five monks, not adhering to their own agreement, having gone towards the Buddha, one received his bowl and robe, one made ready a seat, one brought water for washing his feet, a footstool and a footstand. The Buddha sat down on a seat made ready, and the Buddha, while he was sitting down, washed his feet. Further, they addressed the Buddha by name with an epithet of your reverence. When this was said, the Buddha spoke thus to the group of five monks, "Do not, monks, address a truth finder by name and with the epithet, your reverence." A truth finder monk is a perfected one, a fully enlightened one. Give ear, monks, the deathless has been found. I instruct, I teach Dhamma. Going along in accordance with what has been enjoined, having soon realized here and now by your own super knowledge that supreme goal of the Brahma faring, for the sake of which young men of family rightly go forth from the home life to the homeless, you will abide in it. When this was said, the group of five monks spoke to the Lord, "But you, Reverend Gotama, did not come to this state of a further man, to the eminence of truly Aryan vision by knowledge. By this conduct, by this course, by this practice of austerities," they were still heavy into the belief that if you just eat this one food, that you'll become enlightened. "So how can you now come to state of further men, to the eminence of the truly Aryan vision of knowledge, when you live in abundance, are wavering and striving, and have reverted to the life of abundance?" When this was said, the Buddha spoke thus to the group of five monks, "A truth finder monk does not live in abundance, does not waver in striving, he does not revert to the life of abundance. A truth finder monk is a perfected one, a fully enlightened one. Give ear, monks, the deathless has been found. I instruct, I teach, going along in accordance with what was been enjoined, having soon realized here and now by your own super knowledge that supreme goal of the Brahma faring, for the sake of which young men of family rightly go forth from the home life into the homeless, you will abide in it." For a second time did the group of five monks speak thus to the Lord. And a second time did the Lord speak thus to the group of five monks. And a third time did the group of five monks speak thus to the Buddha, "But you, Reverend Gotama, did not come to this state of further men. By this practice of austerities, you live in a life of abundance." When this was said, the Buddha spoke thus to the group of five monks, "Do you allow, monks, that I have never spoken to you like this before?" "You have not, Reverend Sir. A truth finder, monks, is a perfected one, a fully enlightened one. Give ear, and you will abide in the superhuman knowledge." And the Buddha was able to convince the group of five monks. Then the group of five monks listened to the Buddha again, gave ear to him, and aroused their minds with profound knowledge. Then the Buddha addressed the five monks, saying, "These two dead ends, monks, should not be followed by one who has gone forth. Which two? That which is among sense pleasures, addiction to attractive sense pleasures. Lo, of the village or of the average man, un-Aryan, not connected with the goal, and that which is addiction to self-torment, ill, un-Aryan, not collected with the goal. Now, monks, without adopting either of these two dead ends, there is a middle course, fully awakened to by the truth finder, making for vision, making for knowledge, which conduces to calming, to super knowledge, to awakening, to nibbana. And what, monks, is this middle course fully awakened to by the truth finder? Making for vision, making for knowledge, which conduces to calming, to super knowledge, to awakening, to nibbana. It is this Aryan Eightfold Path itself that is harmonious perspective, harmonious imaging, harmonious communication, harmonious movement, harmonious lifestyle, harmonious practice, harmonious observation, harmonious collectedness. This, monks, is the middle course, fully awakened to by the Pathfinder, making for vision, making for knowledge, which conduces to calming, to super knowledge, to awakening, to nibbana. And this, monks, is the Aryan truth of suffering. Birth is suffering, old age is suffering, and disease is suffering, and dying is suffering, association with what is not dear is suffering, separation from what is dear is suffering, not getting what one wants is suffering. In short, the five groups of grasping are ill. This is talking about the five aggregates that may or may not be affected by clinging, depending on your training and practice. And this, monks, is the Aryan truth of the uprising of suffering. That which is craving, connected with again becoming, accompanied by delight and passion. Finding delight in this and that, that is to say, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for becoming, craving for non-becoming. And this, monks, is the Aryan truth of the stopping of suffering, the utter and passionless stopping of that very craving. Now you're starting to catch it. When you let go and relax, you have let go of the craving for that moment. As you keep purifying your mind by doing that, you go more and more subtle until finally you will get to the cessation of perception and feeling. Stopping of that very craving, its renunciation, surrender, release, the lack of pleasure in it. And this, monks, is the Aryan path of the course leading to the cessation of suffering. This Aryan Eightfold Path itself, that is to say, harmonious perspective, harmonious imaging, harmonious communication, harmonious movement, harmonious lifestyle, harmonious practice, harmonious observation, and harmonious collectedness. On thinking, this is the Aryan truth of suffering. Among things not heard before by me, monks, vision arose, knowledge arose, wisdom arose, higher knowledge arose, light arose. The light, the Pali word is obasa, and it means radiance, not so much light. On thinking, now that which is the Aryan path of suffering must be completely known. Now that which is the Aryan path of the truth of suffering is completely known. Among things not heard before by me, monks, vision arose, knowledge arose, wisdom arose, higher knowledge arose, radiance arose. on thinking this is the noble truth of the arising of suffering. Then we go through that whole thing again. A vision arose, knowledge arose, wisdom arose, higher knowledge arose, and radiance arose. On thinking now that which is the Aryan truth of the arising of suffering, it must be given up, is given up. On thinking this is the Aryan path of the stopping of suffering, radiance arose. On thinking now that which is the Aryan truth of the cessation of suffering must be realized, is realized. On thinking this is the Aryan truth of the course going to the cessation of suffering. He went through all of that, and then the radiance arose. On thinking now that which is the Aryan truth of the course leading to the cessation of suffering must be made to become, is made to become. And so, monks, the vision of knowledge of these four Aryan truths, with the three sections and the 12 modes as they truly are, was not well purified by me. So long was I, monks, not thoroughly awakened with the supreme full awakening as to the world with its devas, with its maras, with its brahmas, with its recluses and brahmas, its creatures, with its devas and men. This I knew. But when, monks, the vision of knowledge of these four Aryan truths, with the three section and 12 modes, as they truly are, was well purified by me, then was I, monks, thoroughly awakened with the supreme awakening as to the world, with its recluses and Brahmins, its creatures, with devas and men. This I knew. Moreover, the vision of knowledge arose in me. Freedom of mind is for me unshakable. This is the last birth. There is not now again becoming. Thus spoke the Lord. Delighted, the group of five monks rejoiced in the Buddha's utterance. Moreover, while the discourse was being uttered, Dhamma visions, dustless, stainless, arose in the venerable Kodanya, that whatever is in the nature to arise, all that is of the nature to stop. And when the Buddha had rolled the Dhamma wheel, the earth devas made this sound heard. The supreme Dhamma wheel, rolled thus by the Blessed One, at Benares in the deer park at Isipatana, cannot be rolled back by a recluse or Brahmin or Deva or by Mara or by Brahma or by anyone in the world. Having heard the sound of the earth Devas, the Devas of the four great kings made their sound heard. The 30 Devas, the Yama Devas, the happy Devas, the Devas who delight in creation, the Devas who delight in the creation of others, the Devas of Brahmas, Ritinyu, made this sound heard. The supreme Dhamma wheel, rolled thus by the Lord at Benares in the deer park at Isipatana, cannot be rolled back by a recluse or Brahmin or Deva or Mara or by Brahma or anyone in the world. In this wise, at that moment, in that second, in that instant, the sound reached as far as the Brahma world, and the 10,000-fold world system trembled. Yeah. Quaked, shook violently, and a radiant, splendid, measureless, surpassing the Deva's own glory, was manifest in the world. Then the Buddha uttered the solemn utterance, indeed, Kodanya has understood. Indeed, Kodanya has understood. Thus it was that Kodanya became the Venerable Kodanya's name, Anyata Kodanya. Then the Venerable Anyata Kodanya, having seen Dhamma, attained Dhamma, known Dhamma, plunged into Dhamma, having crossed over doubt, having put away uncertainty, having attained without another's help to the full confidence in the teacher's instruction, spoke thus to the Lord, "May I, Lord, receive the going forth in the Lord's presence. May I receive ordination?" "Come, monk," the Lord said, "well taught is the Dhamma fair, the Brahma faring for making an utter end of ill. So this came to be this Venerable One's ordination." When the Buddha ordained somebody, he didn't have to go through any ceremonies to do it. All he said was, "Come, monk." Then the Buddha instructed those remaining monks with a talk on the Dhamma. Now, this is an important fact. Kodanya became a Sotapanna by hearing the Dhamma and understanding it. In other words, his intelligence was enough that he could grasp the sum of the subtlety of dependent origination, which is really what the Buddha was talking about with the Four Noble Truths. So when you attend to a Dhamma talk, especially if it's read from the suttas, and you attend very attentively and listen very deeply, you can become a Sotapanna from that understanding. Then the Buddha instructed the remaining monks with Dhamma talk. Then, while they were being instructed by the Buddha with Dhamma talk, Dhamma vision, dustless, stainless, arose in the Venerable Vapa and to the Venerable Bhadiya, that whatever is of the nature to arise, all that is of the nature to stop. Now, this makes it sound like he was talking about impermanence. But what he was actually talking about was dependent origination. When you see the cause and you let go of the cause, then it won't arise. Thus, having seen Dhamma, attained Dhamma, known Dhamma, having attained without another's help to full confidence in the teacher's instruction, spoke thus to the Buddha, "May we, Lord, receive the going forth in the Lord's presence. May we receive ordination. Come, monks, well taught is the Dhamma fair, the Brahma faring for making an utter end of suffering." So this came to be these monks' ordination. Then the Buddha, eating the food brought back by these, instructed the remaining monks with Dhamma talk, saying, "Let the group of six live on whatever the three monks bring when they have walked for alms food." Then, while they were being instructed by the Lord with Dhamma talk, Dhamma vision, dustless and stainless, arose in the Venerable Mahanama and the Venerable Asaji. Asaji was the one that Sariputta went and asked, became a Sotapanna with his exhortation, that whatever is of the nature to arise, all that is of the nature to stop. These, having seen Dhamma, attained Dhamma, having attained without another's help in the full confidence in the teacher's instruction, spoke thus to the Lord, "May we, Lord, receive the going forth in the Lord's presence. May we receive ordination. Come, monks, well taught is the Dhamma fair, the Brahma faring for making an utter end of suffering." So there came to be these Venerable Ones' ordination. Then the Lord addressed the five monks, saying, "Body, monks, is not self. Now, were this body self, monks, this body would not tend to sickness, and no one would get a chance of saying in regard to the body, let body become thus for me, let body not become thus for me. But inasmuch, monks, as body is not self, therefore body tends to sickness, and one does not get the chance of saying in regard to the body, let the body become thus for me, let the body not become thus for me. Feeling is not self. Perception is not self. Consciousness is not self. So what do you think, monks? Is body permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But is that which is impermanent painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, and of the nature to change? As this is mine, this I am, this is myself? No, it is not, Lord. Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord, but is that which is impermanent painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But if it is fit to consider that which is impermanent and painful of a nature to change, as this is mine, this I am, this is myself, it is not, Lord. What do you think, monks? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But is that which is impermanent painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, and subject to change, as this is mine, this I am, this is myself? It is not, Lord. Are formations permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But that which is impermanent, painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord, but is it fit to consider that which is impermanent and painful and subject to change, as this is mine, this I am, this is myself? It is not. Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord, but is that which is impermanent painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, and of a nature to change, as this is mine, this I am, this is myself? It is not, Lord. Wherefore, monks, whatever is body, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, low or excellent, whatever it is, far or near, all bodies should be, by means of right wisdom, be seen as it actually is thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Whatever feeling, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, low or excellent, whether it is far or near, all feelings should by means of right wisdom be seen as it actually is thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Wherever, monks, whatever is perception, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, low or excellent, whether it is far or near, all bodies should by means of right wisdom be seen as it actually is thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Whatever are the volitions, whether past, future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, low or excellent, whether it is far or near, all volition should, by means of right wisdom, be seen as it actually is. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Whatever is consciousness, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, low or excellent, whether far or near, all consciousness should, by means of right wisdom, be seen as it actually is. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Seeing in this way, monks, the instructed disciple of the Aryan disregards body, and he disregards feeling, and he disregards perception, and he disregards formations, and he disregards consciousness. Disregarding, he is dispassionate. Through dispassion, he is freed. In freedom, the knowledge comes to be, I am freed, and he knows destroyed is birth. Lived is the Brahma faring, done is what was to be done. There is no more being such or such. Thus spoke the Buddha, delighted the group of five monks, rejoiced in what the Buddha said. Moreover, while this discourse was being uttered, the mind of the group of the five monks was freed from the cankers without grasping. At that time, there were six perfect ones in the world. The second discourse, the first one is really important. You can't get away from that. But the second discourse on anatta is the most powerful. Because as you're seeing this as an impersonal process, the dispassion comes up because this stuff is always coming up, it's always there, and you're letting go of the craving, and you're letting go of all this other stuff. And realizing that this is truly nothing but an impersonal thing, that realization is the one that helps one to become an arahat. Now, why do I stress that impersonal nature so much?
It moves you over to the non-judgmental observer very quickly.
Yes.
So that you observe the process, attempt to observe the process.
You can observe it much more quickly if you're not tied to it. And you're tied to it by craving, and the craving is subtle stuff, very subtle, because the craving is the cause of the vibration.
And the craving is a locked-in habitual tendency.
So locked in.
However old we are.
And more.
Lifetime after lifetime.
From time immemorial, we've all been thinking that this thing that we call a body and mind is us. That's who we are. I had somebody write to me today. She claims to be some kind of lama. And she told me that I don't believe in conventions, and I don't believe in one path being the correct path. And I'll give you an example. I follow my heart. She said, I was out walking and I saw a squirrel get hit. It didn't get killed. So I went to it and I had such compassion for that being that I wanted to release it from suffering, so I killed it. You think I didn't have a heyday writing back to that? I told them that they were so caught up in themselves that they didn't see what true compassion was. If they would have been really compassionate, instead of killing that being and causing more fear and anxiety to arise, should have sat down and radiated loving kindness to it until it died. Take it home. carry it very carefully. Respect that life. But she thinks that she really knows a lot of stuff. But what was she doing? She was so caught up in the pain of another being and taking it on herself that she didn't see her emotional attachment to the dislike of the situation, and she took that whole situation very, very personally, and thinking that she's some kind of an enlightened being. And she told me of her pain after she killed that being, knowing that that was the wrong thing. It was against the precepts to kill. And I wrote back about compassion towards oneself, as well as towards all other beings. But this gives you an idea. This is the Book of Discipline that I've been reading from. Kind of fun story, isn't it? And it actually goes into the next part of the story, is how he trained all of the first 60 disciples, and they were all from very rich families. But the whole thing is, if your merit is good enough to come from a rich family, that means that you have at least the potential for understanding, if you don't get caught by the craving of everything and enjoyment of the sense pleasures. Okay, why don't we share some merit then? May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we have thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddhist dispensation. So.